All right, we're going to go ahead and get started at 6:32. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Esri?
Present.
Michaels?
Present.
Rodriguez?
Here.
Sexton? Store?
Present.
Straub?
Yes.
Locke?
Here. All right. First up is approval of the agenda. Would anybody like to make a motion? Esri?
Yes, thanks. I'd like to make the motion to amend the agenda by adding the Honorable Judge Dwyer as the new A1 and then shift 1, 2, and 3 down one space as they're presented in order now. So 1 becomes 2, 2, 3, and 3, 4.
Thank you. Do I have a second for that? Emily, thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay, great. Moving on, we have approval of the minutes. Did everybody have a chance to review the minutes sent out via the email today?
Michaels.
Okay, Michaels.
Second, Straub.
Straub. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Moving on. I see no public participation. Are there any communications from the board? I just want to add, earlier this week, I had a meeting at an undisclosed location in Urbana. When I stepped into the restroom, I saw used Narcon packaging, and then being the nosy person I am, I checked my favorite police scanner app and saw that there was never a call there, so the Narcon did its job. There was no sign of anyone needing emergency services at that place. It's unfortunate it needed to be done, but it was a nice surprise to see it used effectively and that it saved one overdose, at least from going into the system. So, seeing no other communications, let's move on to new business. Up for A1, we have Judge Dwyer. Would you like to come forward and tell us about drug court? just push the button when you see a red light. You know the mic is on.
All right. Mic is on. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Judge Ben Dwyer. I'm a circuit judge here in Champaign County. And since June, I've been the judicial member of the Champaign County Drug Court, which is an Illinois problem-solving court. The message I have for you today is very brief. I learned I was speaking about 10 o'clock this morning, and I understand some people have PowerPoint presentations, so I'm happy to go first. Then I won't be concerned about how poorly I've prepared. But what I want to tell you is this. The Illinois problem-solving courts are designed in the justice system to treat things like addiction differently than we would treat ordinary criminal rule-breaking. And it's a recognition that you cannot prosecute your way out of a phenomenon that more closely resembles a public health epidemic than a endemic of moral turpitude or something like that. And the philosophy works something like this. Instead of punishment, which is what is normally meted out upon a plea of guilty or a judgment of conviction, we invest a tremendous amount of resources in someone who everyone would agree is a terrible investment. They can't hold a job. They can't stop breaking the law. Oftentimes, their social relations are frayed, and they may be in mental health crisis as well. So the way in which it operates is we have people plead into drug court. It's a voluntary program, and you have to want to do it. You can't be forced into drug court because you have to voluntarily surrender a number of personal liberties in order to participate. But the general trajectory of drug court is that we have a team discussion. The team consists of the judge. We have a member of the public defender's office. Currently, it's Liz Pollack. There's a member from the state's attorney's office. Currently, it's Enchi Lin. We have someone from the probation office. That's Max White. We have a drug court coordinator, Kyle Schiebert. We have partners at Rosecrantz. We have a member from CU at Home. We have someone from Task Probation, and we have someone from Champaign County Family Services. That's the drug court team. In a nutshell, we meet every Monday morning. We discuss everybody in drug court for a review, and the discussion is for applicants. Will we let them in? Do they meet the criteria? We screen people carefully. What we look for is, does this person actually have a serious substance abuse problem that we can treat? And is the offense probationable? If it's not probationable, then the state's attorney has to agree to file a probationable charge to which they could plead to enable them to enter into drug court. So there's a sort of conversation and negotiation that takes place at the outset to get someone into drug court. Once they're accepted, we look at the diagnostic criteria we're given during the application process to determine whether someone needs to begin their treatment with, for example, intensive outpatient treatment, residential treatment, and if they're in custody at the jail, whether they need to be held in custody for further residential treatment or whether they can be released out for intensive outpatient treatment. The risk being, and this may already be obvious to all of you, but people who have been incarcerated for some amount of time, they lose their tolerance to opiates, and the risk of an overdose or lethal overdose is much greater if you've been incarcerated for 3 months. And so sometimes if someone is in severe addiction and needs residential treatment, and a professional clinician recommends that they go directly to residential treatment, which could be 30 is the most common, sometimes 60 days, we will take them directly from the jail to residential treatment center as soon as one opens up. We partner most frequently with Moreland here in Champaign. It's just by the hardware store on North Prospect, Menards. And it's when people get out of residential treatment, they're usually in intensive outpatient treatment. But the way that it works is we move people through a treatment program. Eventually, the goal is this. We take someone who is in sort of social and legal freefall. When we meet them, usually they're visibly withdrawing. Sometimes when they do the plea to enter into drug court, sweating, sometimes shaking. We want to take that person and in a year and a half, 2 years, sometimes 3 years, get that person sober into a stable housing placement connected with social services they need, health insurance, and hopefully employment so that they can continue a stable living situation going forward after drug court graduation. So that's the goal that we have. Germane to your topic, the most difficult substance that we tackle is opioid. That's the one we get overdose deaths on. My experience coming to the Champaign County Drug Court began at the Public Defender's Office. I counted earlier today, I think I can think of five people who I knew well and represented who died of opioid overdoses while I was representing them. There are a much larger number of people who I've read their names in the obituaries, and I suspect that they have died of an overdose, but I'm not currently representing them, and so I don't know. So it's something that has affected me personally, and we have lost, when I was a public defender and since I've become a judge, we have had people overdose and die in Champaign County Drug Court, which is obviously tragic. So it's something we feel strongly about, the effect of opioid use and abuse in the community. The purpose you have brought me here for, I understand, is to figure out where to spend your money. But I hope I've answered the question on how does drug court work, and I'll wait for another one.
I'll start if we're ready for questions. Obviously, it's sad. It's always sad when we lose anyone, and this is very difficult. What has been, have there been success stories as well in drug court with the opioid addicted participants?
There have, and I think one of the main success stories on the treatment side is the push for medication assisted treatment. We have a number of resources at our disposal, which again require buy-in by the probationer, but there are things we use like Vivitrol, which can diminish cravings for people who have opioid addiction, and it's a shot. So it's something you go and get It's not like a pill you have to take every day. You have to go get a shot. But the effect of it endures for quite some time. And that's been tremendously helpful. With opioids, you're often trying in the drug court world just to stabilize someone long enough so that the treatment can start to work. None of these things work overnight. Sometimes, you know, they don't work for more than a year. The trauma counseling and the family counseling and all these sorts of things, and housing stability and getting plugged in with a mental health professional. So the main thing is that you not die. And one of the main resources we have is medication-assisted treatment, which has improved our outcomes over time.
Who pays for the medication-assisted treatment?
So the most of our clients are eligible for insurance, and one of the things we do is help them apply and get insurance. I believe they and their insurance pay for the vast majority of residential treatment. That comes with some problems. There are some kind of crazy rules about getting people into residential treatment. I haven't cataloged them all for you this evening, but an example is if you have too much clean time, they won't take you. So if you have burgled 9 different residential homes just seeking pills directly or items to trade for pills, and you've been locked up for a long time because the state's attorney has said, absolutely not, this is non-probationable, I don't agree to probation, that person has been jailed for a long time, and then finally someone relents and agrees to allow them to plead into drug court. The recommendation is for immediate residential treatment, and the insurance rules and the residential treatment center say, we won't take this person because they've been clean for 180 days, so they don't qualify for our services. That presents a challenge to us when we know and have a clinician opining that this person is a serious overdose risk.
Ms. Michaels?
Just a question. I'm not real familiar with all of this, but what is the responsibility of the courts after you send them to this rehab? Do they come back to you and then you go through a process, or are you still structured to be involved with them this whole time?
We stay involved with them until either they graduate from drug court or they have their probation revoked and are sent ordinarily to the Department of Corrections. Normally, residential treatment comes first, 30 days. Someone comes back and we'll put them in intensive outpatient. They have weekly meetings with an individual counselor through Rosecrans. Then we'll put them in groups. There's an MRT. I don't know if the people here are familiar with moral recognition therapy. MRT is what we put people in, which is lengthy. We put people through cognition works. If there are relationship issues, we'll have them meet with a family counselor. We snow them under with services at first, and we keep them so busy that that's basically all they can do. As they progress in their treatment, the idea and the best practice in drug courts, according to new national standards, which we adhere to very well in Illinois and in Champaign particularly, is to roll back treatment, and then you allow that person to begin working and begin doing other things. But you're replacing treatment with other positive things. You just don't want to suddenly give somebody nothing to do. I hope that answered your question.
Any other questions? Dr. Storr.
Thank you, Jen. one of the first things that I did as a county board member, because of the when I came on, was I attended a drug court graduation and got to talk with Judge Ford and some of the people that you mentioned. And I know that Sheriff Dr. Dustin Herman asked for a dedicated deputy to work with the drug court. Could you elaborate on how what that role might be?
Yes, and I'm concerned that I've neglected to say the Sheriff's Department representative when I gave you the accounting of drug court people. But there is a Sheriff's Department representative, and it's Detective Brad Wakefield. brings a law enforcement perspective to the staffings, but also he is the eyes and ears of the drug court. So when we are concerned about a domestic situation, there's a rumor the boyfriend who abused our probationer has moved back in. This is now an answerable question, and we can send Detective Wakefield over to the house. He'll knock on the door, have a conversation with our probationer. Sometimes the boyfriend answers the door. I'm speaking hypothetically, of course. He'll come in sometimes. He'll open the refrigerator, make sure there's no beer in there, things like that. He can go look in the community and talk to people in a way that the attorneys and the judge can't, and the clinicians don't have time to do running the groups. So, yes, that's A, very important, and B, very helpful to us because it gives us information that otherwise is just not at our disposal.
If I might, I think that that's only a halftime position right now, or is that full time?
I don't think it's a full time position, and I know that this is the strain at the courthouse. That drug court is a tremendous investment in terms of everybody's time and resources. The public defender not only has to be present at the staffing and at court, they have to set up the plea and negotiate the plea. Their clients are calling them about drug court-specific problems. Similarly, the state's attorney has to draft the pleadings that will either get someone in or get someone out of drug court via petition or revoke probation. So there's a lot of overhead that goes into this. It's not a full-time position. Everybody is just trying to make it work with their other responsibilities. And I know that is a source of stress at the courthouse.
Any other questions? Michelle, did I see?
If this task force gave you money, what would you do with it?
If they gave money to the drug court? Well, I would want to study how we could best use that money. I have a couple concerns off the bat. One, there are rare cases where I think people need to go to residential treatment. And because of the insurance rules and the way the treatment centers set up their intake, we can't get people in directly. So we have talked in the past about a narrow band of cases where someone needs to go to residential treatment immediately, but we basically need to pay cash to do it. There are other, have applied for and received a cumbersome grant through the Illinois Redeploy Act. It has turned out to be an exercise in kind of nightmarish accounting in terms of what they want us to tell them we're going to use the money for and how they want us to tell them we're going to use it and when they want us to tell them we're going to use it. We basically haven't figured out how to meaningfully access the money that we were awarded. So that's been a frustration. But one of the things we would like to do are, in some cases, we have people who lose their housing, are disconnected from their housing, often through no fault of their own. There was a fire in one case I'm thinking of when I was a drug court public defender. And we had a displaced person who had really kind of begun to stabilize. And that person was in need of not an overnight stay at a hotel, but sort of medium-term housing subsidy that wasn't like a group home, which is where a lot of people are at the beginning parts of treatment. They were more stable, but they needed a place, and we risked losing progress that we had made with addiction in such a case. So we've talked about kind of emergency things like that. I don't have a complete answer on exactly how we want to spend the funds. If we get them. I can tell you if we surveyed county offices, they would tell you that time is tight on personnel. And drug court is time intensive. It's basically a whole day a week for me and for the attorneys as well. So they have not lightened up their other caseloads, so they now have about 4 days to do 5 days worth of work that are not related to drug court.
Seeing nothing else, thank you very much for joining us on short notice.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have the Champaign-Urbana Public Health Department. If you can come on forward. Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, I'm from the County Board of Health, and really this is probably the same presentation, so we'll double up.
All right, so just to be clear, we've got Board of Health and Public Health Department at the same time?
Yes.
Okay, great, thank you.
You want to go first? You want me to go first?
Why don't you probably got something more prepared. I'm off the cuff.
I'm more off the cuff, too, but I'm Joe Trotter. I'm the program coordinator for the harm reduction program at Champaign-Urbana Public Health. So I can speak a little bit about our program and at least kind of what we're seeing. Our program provides services directly to the drug-using population within Champaign-Urbana, Champaign County, and surrounding areas. We do that primarily through our Safer Syringe program, traditionally called like a syringe exchange program. We supply clean equipment to people to while they're using drugs to lessen their risks and lessen their harms of passing a disease or getting a serious infection. And then we also have a pretty substantial grant from the state of Illinois to provide Narcan out to not only Champaign County, but to surrounding counties around that. We do that through a variety of different ways. Right now, there's no one that's not a good candidate to carry Narcan with them. So traditionally, we would give the Narcan directly to the drug-using population, which is good, but we also need to have other individuals prepared to be bystanders in case the emergency happens next to them. So a lot of the push right now is to get Narcan out to anyone who wants to carry it and educate people about the reasons why they need to carry it, how to respond appropriately. And Narcan's just just in case people don't know, but it's a medication that is used when someone experiences the emergency that is an overdose. Overdoses are rarely planned or expected. They are accidents that happen. So Narcan is a medication that's given to them when this accident happens to reverse the effects of the overdose. It works really, really well. And it's used to save lives. So the intent of our program and the intent from the state is to supply Narcan to, we're going to cast a wide net with it. So we want to get Narcan out. The data tells us that the more Narcan we distribute, the less death we will have in an area. So that's the intention of our program. So far this year, we've given out about 9,000 kits. And the year's not even over with, so we're kind of on track to give around 10,000 kits per year. We have at least 17 reversals that have been reported to us. A lot of overdose reversals go unreported because it's difficult for people to talk about those situations. So, but we don't need them to report it for us to know that it works. The data tells us that it works. So primarily what we're doing right now and what we're seeing right now is we are seeing an increase of overdoses. It is following the same national trends as everywhere else. Overdoses are going up. Overdoses are getting worse. People are using drugs more. Some of that is because of post-pandemic. We saw national trends that fit in here that more people are using drugs now. More particularly using opiates, and the risk of fentanyl, which is an opiate, getting into the drug supply that's on the street. And that can happen with any type of pill, drug, medication that gets out onto the street. It runs a risk of being tampered with. So someone might use a pill and not know what it contains. So that then causes a real high risk of someone being exposed to something like fentanyl, which is a strong opiate that they can't tolerate. So we have some fentanyl testing that's done here where we provide individuals with fentanyl test strips, which is a little kind of two-minute device that you can use. You add a little bit of the drug to some water, and that tells you if fentanyl is present. And then that would allow someone who is potentially using that drug to make a more informed choice as to whether they want to do that or if they need a better safety plan in place. We also promote a national program called Never Use Alone. So you can't save yourself from an overdose. You have to, someone has to save you. Someone has to respond in order to stop the overdose. And Never Use Alone is it's a national hotline that can be called, and it puts someone in touch with a operator who will call emergency services on their behalf if they become unresponsive during the time of the call. It's a really powerful program, and it's really good for people who are using on their own. They're not using with others or in a community setting. What else do we promote? We do our syringe exchange and our Narcan program through you could call it a vending machine style, but it's not that fancy. But we do some very low barrier ways to help people get the supplies they need during times when we're not open. Traditionally, they would come inside, they'd talk to us, and we would give them whatever supplies they need. But we've started doing, right around the pandemic, we started doing all right, come around to the back alley of our building and we have supplies available for you in this little lockbox that people can access. And that has become a very popular way for our clients to get supplies from us. It's hard to walk into a building and say, I need clean syringes. We try to make it as easy as possible, but that still can be a barrier for some folks. We have Narcan available out there as well, so people can get Narcan. And again, in a no-barrier kind of way. So that's a little bit about kind of where we're at right now. Oh, I should add one more thing. Another kind of emerging issue that we're seeing nationally is xylazine, which is it's a horse tranquilizer that is getting added into the drug. It's a tranquilizer, not an opiate, which means Narcan does not work on it if someone takes too much than they need. We know that it's coming. Usually drugs kind of happen whatever happens at the coasts kind of flows inward. And so Philadelphia, New York are seeing a lot of xylazine in their drug supply. We did get some funding from Illinois Department of Public Health to get xylazine test strips, and that will be coming fairly soon for us. Again, allowing someone to use a drug with more information, which will hopefully help them make a better decision at that time about how to stay safe. So that's just kind of one emerging thing that we know. We had one xylazine-related death last year. The data tells us we had one last year. So we assume we're going to have more. It's just kind of how drugs work.
Ms. Michaels?
Got a question for you here.
When sure.
You first started, you talked about you have a grant for Narcan, which is great because then the supply is there.
Yeah.
We have that.
Yeah.
And you talked about putting this in the hands of many of the people in the public.
Yeah.
Couple things that I would be concerned about is liability.
Yep.
And then there has to be a plan or some kind of structure of who and how you train this.
Yes.
Because you just can't give it to everybody right away because maybe some people are not going to be able to understand the purpose.
Sure. And I can speak to that. So there's a standing medical order that covers the entire state of Illinois, any person that's in it, that allows them to carry and administer Narcan without any risk of liability or without... basically, you can't put Narcan in someone conscious is kind of the way the rules are written. So there's a standing medical order that covers the entire state. And I would also argue that I think people nowadays are more liable if they don't have Narcan because Narcan is free, easily available, and it's really, really easy to use. It's just a nasal spray, and it will not affect someone if they don't have opiates in their system. So if you come across someone that's unconscious and you're not going to be able to assess them of what have you taken today? What's going on with you? What's your pulse like? So it can be used even if someone's experiencing a heart attack, stroke, seizure, fainting. It can be used on anything. It's either going to affect the opiates if they're present, or nothing's going to happen at all. So it's a very, very safe medication, which is why Illinois made this push to make this standing medical order. In other words, to reduce more barriers for people to carry and use it. Yeah, so part of our plan, part of what we always talk about is the Good Samaritan law, and we give out Narcan, we also talk to people about how to use it. You don't have to be like professionally trained in order to use Narcan, but we do a very quick kind of like, you need to spray it into the nose, get the person safe, try and do some CPR, get them, you know, someplace secure, calling 911 for help, staying with them. So we try and include that in everything. Conversation when we give people Narcan, but then we also have flyers and brochures that we give out about the Good Samaritan law, what kind of protections are in place for them, because there are specific protections in place for an opiate overdose.
I just have a question about availability within the community, because your grant is for the whole state, and it sounds like it's very easy to get by coming to the office on Kenyon Road.
Yes.
Very easy. What about our neighbors in Rantoul or out in the county? Is there any plan for like disseminating it out there, or do people just need to come in and get it?
Yeah, so we do some delivery of Narcan, and I have a staff of four individuals that I work with, and a lot of what we do is out of the building, where we will drive through Rantoul or Tolono or Mahama and go through businesses, schools, pharmacies, places that are open to the public and say, hey, we have kits of Narcan, do you want some? So we spend time doing that currently, but it's obviously not enough. There's always more that we could do. And so that's why we've had discussions about, you know, do we need to set up maybe not vending machines, but something like a vending machine in a location where someone can walk up and go, hey, there's Narcan that's here that I can take. They take a kit of Narcan. The kits have instructions about how to use them. And again, reduce those barriers because, yes, someone in Rantoul might not be able to even drive down here to get Narcan. So, yeah, that's one way that we want to try and expand what we're doing to more areas.
Ms. Straub?
To Diane's last point, Joe and his coworker at one point came to Cunningham Township and did a training, and this was pre-pandemic, so we know like a lifetime ago.
Yeah.
And I still feel, you know, and I'm a squeamish human, I am, and I still feel very comfortable and very confident with my little Narcan in my diaper bag. And so I would say that that has been really effective for everybody on my staff, and we have come in contact with people who needed it, and we hand it out regularly. Do you do those workplace trainings pretty often, Joe? Is that something? Thank you.
Yeah, we do. We do. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but we do a lot. We've done a lot more trainings now that the pandemic has slowed down. Some of those we do fairly routinely. We're in the jail once a week to provide the training and the kits for people to take upon release. We go to Rosecrans several times a month to train people that are inpatient there, so that way they can have a kit upon release and potentially use it in their homes, their neighborhoods. Part of what we tell people is you're not taking the kit for yourself. You're taking the kit for that person that you're thinking about in your neighborhood, in your life, in your family. The intention, the other thing too is kind of like with Cunningham Township, we will give agencies kits to give to their clients. It's not just for the agency to use, but no, take these, give them out, give them to the people that you know might need them. Even to the people that you don't know might need them, they might be interested and want to carry them just in case too, which is terrific for us.
Any other questions? Okay, I've got a couple more. Sorry.
No, it's okay.
So I guess with all of the safer syringe, is everything you've described tonight, is that mostly grant-funded and it already has a source of funding?
Currently, our harm reduction program does not have a source of funding. So that is something that we have a little bit of funding through a hepatitis C grant through Illinois Department of Public Health. It's not much. So we get some supplies from the state for free. So they have syringes that they will send us, which is terrific. That's the big ticket item. But a lot of the other items have to be purchased with by the agency.
Does that also include passing out fentanyl test strips to check a supply for any of that?
Yeah, so the fentanyl test strips that we have right now are ones that were supplied by the state. Okay. We don't know if when we're getting additional ones, so that's kind of a question mark of when we run out. And
do you have a ballpark idea of how much they cost in bulk or anything? Just thinking for sources of where the money should go.
Yeah, so I know I just priced out, there's a test strip, several test strips that test for both xylazine and fentanyl, and I believe they're like $2 each, somewhere between $2 to $6 each. And so that's a device that someone could test their drug for both of these adulterants and maybe be able to make, again, that more informed choice. So that's one product that we've looked at that could be really helpful.
Okay. And the people to whom they're provided, there's no charge for that, right?
Correct.
They're just provided as a public
no
good.
No charge for any of our
okay,
services.
Great.
Yep.
Any other questions? All right. One last one, the same one that we gave to Judge Dyer. If you could give us your wish list, like what if the money, we have about $90,000 a year,
okay.
What would you think it should be used for? This is not a promise of it happening, obviously.
Yeah. No, I get it. No, yeah. I was just talking to someone about this the other day, and a few things I think would be really helpful would be medically assisted recovery within the jail system. People are detoxing within the jails, which is inhumane, that leads them to then leave the jail, and the first thing they're going to want to do when they leave the jail is use, because they've been in withdrawal for 3 days.
And the death rate on discharge is 15 times that on the street.
Yeah. So enabling the jail to provide medically assisted recovery would be a huge win here. A few other things. You can get more advanced drug testing devices. This is something that they do up in Chicago. Like, so you give someone a fentanyl test strip, and that just tells them if fentanyl is present in their drug. But you can also do a drug. You can buy a device that will scan the drug. It's like laboratory equipment that actually scan the drug and tell you exactly how much fentanyl is in it. And whatever else is in it. Is it Sudafed? How much of it is heroin? How much of it is xylazine? So it allows us to do, would allow us to do a much more kind of better surveillance of what our current drug supply is, and then allow people to make better, more informed choices about what type of drug they're using. Because we have a fluctuating drug supply. So when drugs hit the street, we don't know what they are. And it might be sold as, oh, this is a Xanax, but it's not a Xanax. It could be something else. So that's something that we're seeing nationally. So more advanced drug diagnostic would be really great. And then the last one would be, we've talked about doing something like a vending machine style in several places, kind of strategic in some places, that would allow people to get safer supplies, get Narcan without having to talk to someone about it, that they could get those supplies in a no barrier or very low barrier kind of way. And that's a good way to keep the community safe until they're ready to recover.
Okay. So just one question about the advanced diagnostic testing. Obviously, that would be something that public health department would maintain, right? This wouldn't be, and then
probably
we would
yeah.
surveil the drugs within our community. I'm a defense attorney at heart
okay.
here, so I have to ask these
yeah.
questions like, where would the drugs come from? And would
yeah.
we be opening ourselves up to liability by having illegal drugs that
yeah.
we're then knowing are there?
Yeah, great question. So the way that the folks in Chicago that I have talked to, what they do is they can actually test drug residue. So someone could bring a baggie that previously contained drug. You do a swab inside the baggie, and then you can test it and see what it was. So that way you could tell the client, okay, looks like this had X amount of xylazine or whatever in it. So yeah, there would be the legality issue of people potentially bringing drugs to you for testing. And what was your other question?
That was really it. It was okay. Just a matter of without getting all law enforcement on board with the
sure.
safe harbor, I'd worry yeah. about opening up the person bringing in the baggie, the person handling the baggie. I'd be worried about the liability with that. How do they handle that in Chicago, if you know?
Yeah, so I do know now that you said that. So the Chicago Recovery Alliance functions under a research grant. So when you are a participant in a research program, which our program is, and our program is registered with Illinois Department of Public Health, that allows people to carry more than 100 needles without a prescription. It allows them to carry items that have drug residue on them, and it helps them avoid paraphernalia charges because, you know, we need people to bring their old stuff back so it can be properly disposed of and not thrown in an alley or a park or something like that. But if someone is afraid of carrying a needle that's got drug residue on it, they're worried about catching a felony for that. So this, when we have clients that we have collected data on and we can prove that they are clients, then that gives them increased exemptions in the law from those felony charges of drug paraphernalia possession and drug residue possession.
Thank you.
So I'm guessing that's probably the how they get around
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Do either of you know, are there other models that are successful of medically assisted recovery in jail in Illinois?
Yeah, I was going to get into that.
Excellent.
Vivitrol got into the courts very heavily because of the resistance of those of us in the professional community to its success rates, which were not as impressive. And the reason that they're not as impressive as methadone or buprenorphine, Suboxone, is they do a job of dealing with cravings, but they don't do the job of dealing with cravings. So methadone and buprenorphine are opiate agonists. They work on the receptors directly rather than just simply blocking them like Vivitrol does. If you're on Vivitrol, you take a shot of heroin. It doesn't get to where it needs to go. You don't get the euphoria off of it. You also don't get treatment for withdrawal with it, with Vivitrol. With methadone and buprenorphine, those are acting directly on the opioid receptors. However, they're very long-acting drugs, and the effect of an individual being on those for medication-assisted therapy is that after a period of stabilization, they really do not get high off of them anymore. But taken properly, they don't go into withdrawal. So this permits changes in their consciousness from just reflexively looking for another hit to the point where they now are beginning to sort their lives out. And within 3 months, there is just remarkable changes in folks that have gotten stable on therapy. As Joe mentioned, it would be quite critical, I think, in terms of it'd be a real advance if we could start medication-assisted therapy in jails. Start people on buprenorphine or start people on methadone, and when they're discharged, a warm handoff to a treatment agency, not just discharged on the street. What's currently being done in the detox centers is that they are using buprenorphine for detox, but they're not discharging people on it. And all the literature states quite clearly that a discharge from a detox center results in 70% of the folks discharged using within the first week and 90% using again within the first month. And they are no longer tolerant to these drugs. So there is some concern, those of us that follow the data, that they probably would do better if they didn't even go into it, because more of them are going to survive on the street than they are after treatment. So medication-assisted therapy in the jails would be a big advance here. this county has been very good about continuing people's medications when they are incarcerated. That is not true of all counties around here. I will mention Coles County as being about the worst. But Champaign has always allowed folks that are on buprenorphine, in particular, to continue their medication in jail. And as a result, there's a level of stability that, and they come out back to their treatment center. Other things I'd like to talk about that would be helpful to those of us in the treatment community. I'm John Peterson. I'm on the County Board of Health. I've been doing medication-assisted therapy for over 20 years, both methadone and Suboxone. I had probably one of the largest clinics in Champaign County for a while. That has finally opened up to the general practitioner, so it's no longer the province of a few of the specialists, and that has been overall a very good thing. Mm-hmm. I'm also an officer in the Illinois Society of Addiction Medicine, and we work with the Illinois State Medical Society and the state legislature on policy issues. The one we're looking at right now is a safe consumption site demonstration project, likely be located in Chicago. However, I'm trying to talk Joe into doing one here. And he's on board with it, but it's not your average master's thesis. I would like to see more data coming to the public health boards, both the district and the County Board of Health, from the coroner's office. Because I would like to see what, and I would like to see if they are testing adequately for what's out there. I'll just give you an overview of what I see, because I drug test a large number of my patients. I don't see a lot of heroin anymore. 80% of my samples are fentanyl. There's one dealer in town, I believe, talking to my patients, there's one dealer doing heroin. If it is heroin, it's adulterated with fentanyl. This is a cartel thing. Fentanyl is, you don't have to grow fentanyl, and so it's not a plant that needs to be processed. It's coming out of the precursors, or the intact drug are coming out of China. Much of it through Mexico, but it's also coming on container ships, folks. I mean, put a kilo of fentanyl onto a container ship that's got 1,000 containers. You're going to find that, right? The other thing we're seeing, that this was a change probably about 5 years ago, is I'm not seeing much cocaine.
Right.
It's all methamphetamine. Now, methamphetamine is a different actor, and it's... And some folks that are looking for the stimulant high from cocaine are getting methamphetamine, but the cartel or the local drug supplier is also starting to mix fentanyl into it, and then these folks are not tolerant to opioids. So this is where some of the overdoses are, the accidental overdoses are coming from. People that are not looking for fentanyl are getting it. The OxyContin fake pills, the blue 30s, are almost all fentanyl right now. You don't find real oxy anymore. And so depending on how well this is mixed up, it isn't an FDA product. There are sometimes overdoses from these simply because the mix was too high. We do have patients, Joe's clients, who are looking for fentanyl, because they're highly tolerant to street opioids, but very many people, particularly those starting out, are not looking for it. They're looking for heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Heroin lasts longer. A lot of folks that are using heroin only have to use once a day. Fentanyl, we're seeing about four times a day, sometimes six. The xylazine he's talking about is being mixed into the drug supply because it appears to prolong the effect of fentanyl. So So fentanyl is a very short-acting opioid. When they put the horse tranq into it, it lasts longer. But as he said, it's a much more difficult overdose to treat. I still recommend you use a lot of Narcan because we can get rid of the opioid part of it, but mm-hmm. often these folks have to be ventilated or bagged with oxygen because they just simply have to wear it off. Right now we do not have a reversal agent for xylazine. The best reversal agent probably is to build up like a horse, and so, you know, you can tolerate that much. If there's anything more on that, I mean, unfortunately, the debate about medication-assisted therapy with Vivitrol and the court systems is one that folks have to recognize. Some people do very well on Vivitrol. There are injectable forms of buprenorphine now that have the same convenience monthly, but much more effective impact. And people don't like to hear it, but the absolute best treatment is methadone. But that is a method of dispersal that is highly regulated. We're working at the federal level right now in the American Society of Addiction Medicine attempting to open up methadone to primary care on a Canadian model where it is prescribed by primary care, the counseling is done by primary care or specialty groups, but the medication is dispensed in pharmacies. So that brings it out to a much larger audience than we have two methadone clinics in this town. It took forever to get there. We'll leave it at that right now. Get in too much of the specialty here, and I'll lose you.
Mr. Esri?
Yes, maybe just more for my information at least. These drugs that you're talking about for treatment, the Vivitrol and methadone and
buprenorphine, yeah.
Buprenorphine, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
How long, obviously, you know, they come out of detox and you're saying that it isn't long enough on those drugs. Are these some of these drugs, are they lifelong on average, if people do get off of them eventually, you know, how what it would be the average or
them, but a percent. And let me address that, because that's a question. Addiction, opioid addiction, any addiction is a chronic disease. Now, if you're a diabetic, I'm not asking you to get off your diabetes medicine, am I? Hypertensive? No. So I recommend that folks stay on these medication-assisted therapy for at least 2 years. It takes a while for the mind to get rejiggered, but I have many patients that are on it for 15, and, you know, they started out on the street, they started out prostituting, they started out stealing, and now they're supervisors at work. So why screw it up?
That answers my question.
Yeah.
You basically say it varies, but yet.
It varies. But it can be a chronic med.
My question is, I understand.
Yeah.
But with that answer, then there isn't a truly concrete answer. You can say that. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Michaels?
You talked about the medical assistants in the jail and then moving them into rehab, and then we also talked about the drug diagnostic with the CUPHD. Sorry, I'm on. Oh, I thought it was off. Come on. And I wonder what the collaboration is, because you two both have quite a few things that are correlating with trying to solve this. And if
between
there,
us two?
You two.
Oh, very.
Yeah. Which is awesome. That's what we want.
I was doing needle exchange for Joe back in 2000.
Yeah. And that's what we want. We want collaboration between different agencies. And with that, would there be something that you would both do with the funds should they be handed out? And I don't know if it's a little bit of both.
You know the structure of the two boards, and of course we've got the president here who knows it very well. We contract for services through the district. So our programs are their programs. So anything that we would be advocating that the public health district do and they would advocate that they should start would be coordinated. Now, our focus is outside of Champaign-Urbana. So, I mean, a very good site for a lot of this would be the Rantoul unit. And so some programs are coming out of there, but more could come out of there, and staffing could come out of there. Mm-hmm. So that could be some of the use of some of the money, particularly since the county's levy rate is paltry. We certainly use some support if we opened up a Rantoul advocacy unit.
The other thing that I was going to mention, and I can talk to her. That's fine. The other thing I was going to mention, Krista Jones, President, Champaign County Board of Health. Nice to meet all you. The other thing I was going to mention is if you're looking at sectors of the county, what you have to understand is where we're very resource-rich in Champaign-Urbana, we are not as accessible in other sectors of the county. For example, my home community of Broadlands. We don't have a provider, within 20 to 30 miles of when you're, going in other inner directions. So you have delayed emergency response times, and you have a lot of volunteer fire departments and personnels and EMTs who are serving in these communities to provide these services. And so, yes, the accessibility of having Narcan kits available in these communities, working with those volunteers who have some of that semblance of training and doing additional training in those communities with agencies that are functioning as communities is certainly essential. And so I've had conversations as we're all working together about how we can continue that expansion into those areas. So I would like to also see some funds, that cover all of those sectors of our communities and the counties where we don't have as many resources mm-hmm. available or funding or grants or other types of things. And so this would, really be very beneficial in those communities.
Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, gentlelady. We appreciate you coming here and speaking with us tonight and filling us in on so much. And moving on, we have an officer from Rantoul. Please come.
Thank you. I'm going to try to get a PowerPoint to come up here real quick. Maybe.
Connected again for you. Take a second to wake up. Come on. Yeah, it's still hot. There, wow. You can go ahead and put it in there. There you go.
Good evening. Thank you for inviting me to speak tonight. I'm Justin Bouse. I'm with the Rantoul Police Department. I'm the Deputy Chief of Police there. I've been with the police department 23 years, and I'm just going to reiterate some of these things that we heard here tonight from Judge Dyer and Champaign County CU PhD and the Mental Health Board. So just as Judge Dyer said about prosecuting our way out of this, we at the police department understand we're not going to arrest our way out of this, and we don't want to arrest our way out of this. So in Rantoul, we have really been, to me, innovative in some of our approaches to when it comes to dealing with opioid crisis and how it impacts our community with connecting resources and wanting to further those connection points and provide less of Rantoul being on an island and having the resources there to where there's not the barriers with transportation or childcare or things like that that prevent people from seeking treatment for opioid addictions. So in Rantoul, this is year to date, we have handled, and again, this is not everybody, but I'll kind of go into what the 20 people in opioid-based crisis means. So we have a program, which I'll touch on, the 4U program. So those are people that we have reached out to after overdoses, where we have connected them with resources after this has occurred within their, after their overdose, getting them back in the community and trying to connect them with resources both locally and down in Champaign-Urbana. This year, we've had 6 people that needed Narcan administered to them. We unfortunately have had 3 deaths attributed to opioids. And the scary one is that we've had several that have included age ranges from 13 to 20. So we're starting to see it in a younger generation. And again, I'll touch on that a little bit later on. So Narcan, that's kind of been the hot topic tonight. We were trained in 2016 to administer Narcan to people that were experienced overdose due to, at that point, usually heroin. And we've had really countless saves that from this Narcan and introducing Narcan to the officers and being able to be kind of that first line when these calls come out, getting there and administering Narcan quickly and really reversing those effects pretty quickly. As I touched on, we started the 4U Rantoul program initiative back in January 2022. This position currently has a police sergeant, a community social worker that's a village employee, and a grant-funded crisis co-response member through Rose Krantz. And they have a couple different hats they wear, dealing with CIT issues, recidivism, domestic violence. But then another thing is connecting resources and services to people with alcohol and substance abuse addictions. And these includes all those services, health services, mental health services, and ongoing support services. Again, we really, to me, been very innovative with this approach. I know the co-responder model is gaining a lot of traction across the state and across the nation, but I feel like we've kind of hit the ground running with this program and been able to address some of these day-to-day issues to, one, keep people out of the judicial system, and two, not tax our public safety resources dealing with people over and over again that are dealing with these addictions. So some of our future areas of concern, again, I'll touch on it, is the school-age children and the use. It's unfortunately going up. And as you can see, that some is attributed to COVID, but unintentional overdoses in that age range have doubled just in that 1 year alone. And that was 80% due to fentanyl use. And again, we have investigated 2 overdoses, one resulting in the death of children ages 13 to 17. So something that we see that needs to be addressed and has to be addressed very quickly. One of the things that we don't have a lot of support services up there for opioid-specific addiction. We have some all addiction programs, but again, this is a very tailored program that is what we're seeing, and those all addiction programs aren't necessarily addressing just that opioid addiction specifically. And again, it requires a lot of individuals to travel to the Champaign-Urbana area to gain access to these treatment programs. So some of the things that we, again, I kind of took this out of the Exhibit E, the core strategies that were addressed in this as part of this lawsuit and the money that's been divvied out. These are conceptual in nature. I've not specifically have dollars earmarked towards these events or towards these programs, but they are conceptual, but things that we definitely can see growing with our 4U program, our school resource officer program, and things of those nature. Youth focused programs. So again, expanding training and access to schools, I know CUPHD said that there's some access to having Narcan within the school system, but now that we're seeing this touching this younger generation, ensuring that staff, school nurses, other staff know how to administer and have access to Narcan products. But the biggest thing for us is trying to find programs that provide the education and youth-focused education that discourage this and prevent misuse going forward. And then finding evidence-based programs that help prevent this infiltration into the school system and into the younger generation. We want to increase support services. So again, providing that wraparound service to these individuals that are in recovery. You know, there's several programs that we're touching on with this, you know, that they talked about earlier. But how do we ensure that this continues up in Rantoul and we have those available services to the community members that are struggling with this? It could be expanding the telehealth options. It could be bringing mobile intervention up there. You know, there's several mobile clinics that are in and around the county. And then providing peer recovery centers, again, looking at opioid-specific programs to bring to the community instead of all addictions-based. And finally, just preventing it at a community level, you know, bringing community-based education to a whole, not just specifically youth, but the entire community, and engaging those nonprofits and faith-based communities to support these. Again, those may not necessarily be police programs, but would connect those resources so people have this wraparound treatment program within the Rantoul community.
Any questions?
I'll go. First off, thanks for coming.
You're welcome.
Aaron and I are the outlying, and then we have the city here. And it's very important. And what I hear you saying is that taking care of our youth and getting them educated and also having somebody available to them to know that there is help and there's a way to get through this. And then what I heard from the Board of Health was that they actually also are working on programs with that. And I just wonder how we get all of that going, because I know Rantoul is probably the next biggest community within our county, but then we have the Giffords and the Penfields and the Thomasboroughs and the Ludlows and the things of that nature too. And I think sometimes you all reach out to there because our high school actually takes all of those communities in. So there's probably a broader sense of the rural environment that can be honed into the Rantoul as the center hub for some of those other outlying areas. And I don't want to see that let go. It's just saying it's just the community. It's a whole purpose thing here.
Mr. Essery.
You mentioned the traveling, you know, that you don't have the treatment centers necessarily or the amount of them in Rantoul. Are you aware of people that have forgone treatment because they weren't able to get travel to Champaign-Urbana?
I know specifically that there's several barriers when it comes to transportation to and from the Champaign-Urbana area, whether it's from people that are seeking treatment, whether it's people that need to go back and forth to the courthouse, whether it's, you know, for order protections, things like that. There are many barriers that exist there, just being 14 miles up the road.
Yeah.
Okay. And again, trying to overcome those barriers is really what we're trying to do. Again, the telehealth, the mobile clinics, maybe those are a solution. Maybe it's, you know, getting CUPHD or the Mental Health Board to come up there and set up a program. I think it's just a matter of connecting all those resources together to provide access, access to the community.
Okay, thanks, because one thing that just kind of popped into my head, and this isn't necessarily for you, but just a thought was, okay, we've got C-carts, and they're already running. So I don't know, maybe some way to make C-carts available and no cost to those people, not just from Rantoul, but from the outlying communities, if they need to come to Champaign-Urbana or wherever you know, within CCART's range to travel to that, to and from that treatment. That was just something that came into my head while you were giving your presentation. So that's just something that came up, and maybe we would want to try and investigate that somehow.
Yeah, I will touch on the CCARTs because there is CCARTs accessibility at a low cost. Sometimes the schedule prevents because they have to leave early in the morning. They're not coming back till later in the afternoon, where they have to take an entire day off of work or something like that to arrange CCARTs. We've tried to overcome some transportation issues just through, we get transportation awarded to us, and we can give some transportation, but we can't provide all the transportation.
Dr. Storr.
Hi. Aaron, to kind of touch on your CCARTs thing, I, when I was on highway, tried to advocate for, being able to call up on short notice, and the money and the resources just aren't there, and it's that kind of falls right into what you're talking about.
Ms. Michaels.
If I can continue with what you said, we have Eagle Express up there, and I know the village puts some of the money into that, and so do some of the factories, but you're right, it doesn't come for personal health needs or services. It is to get to work and back or go, earlier on to a doctor or something of that nature. The one thing, too, that I'm concerned about is part of this grant is also for education and for training. And I wonder, how do we get that into the schools? How do we start educating and training some of these kids within our school systems? Because that's where we see them the most often. It's going to be hard to gather them up on the street. There's several people that I know in our community that have started different groups to try to get kids to better themselves and to try to be more accountable and find a safe place to be on a certain evening or whatnot. But how do we get this training? How do we get this education into our kiddos, even at the junior high, maybe even the grade school level?
Ms. Job?
I totally agree with what Diane's saying, and I want to couch that with, like, as the officer was saying, evidence-based programming. I came up in the era of DARE, which we've since learned has not been especially effective. So what is the evidence? I don't know. What is the programming that's out there right now? Are there models that are looking effective?
I have not seen, and again, I have not researched a lot into the school models. I'm sure there's some that exist out there, whether they're evidence-based at this point or just really just seeing what works at this point. I'm not sure. But again, I think there's probably something out there that we could at least start with either through our 4U program or through our school resource officer program to begin that education. I think some of it's going to come with education of the school administration and the school board itself to kind of overcome that stigma that this could be a problem in your schools. And so it's going to have to be a selling point to them first. And if it's not at the school level, then it has to be at the individual level or the family level to then address those issues.
Mr. Essery.
I was just going to touch on CCARTs again. And I know what you're saying, Chris, especially with the dedicated lines up at Rantoul, which are meant for more work-related. But CCARTs, and CCARTs has its own issues, don't get me wrong, with keeping drivers and stuff like that. But they do have they'll come out and pick you up if you schedule it. So, my thinking is ahead of a time enough. So if you have a known schedule of you need to come in for treatment, if that could somehow be worked out. I'm not saying it can. Again, and I'm not discounting what you said, Chris, because you're right. I mean, I know the overall funding and stuff to maybe keep it going isn't there and everything, but it's not just the dedicated routes and Rantoul. CCARTs does ultimately have the, hey, I need, a ride into a doctor's appointment on, I forget how many days' notice they need, but 3 days from now is a ride available, and if it is, they'll come out and pick you up and take you in and bring you back. So, again, can that work out? I don't know.
Not to get too far into the weeds. not to get too far into the weeds on the C-cart issue, when I had clients in any sort of treatment, intensive outpatient is the one that if you're not in residential, you're an intensive outpatient when you're first out. You get to call in by 10 a.m. every morning and find out if that's your day when you have to, and you won't be able to call in advance to get that. And unless we can get the services up to where the people are, they would be failing a drug test just for not taking it in time. Dr. Storr.
Thank you. I don't have a lot of experience in this area, but I do know that sometimes that, you know, when a individual makes a decision, this is the time. I've had enough. I'm ready to go. Oh, we've got a transportation problem. There isn't a spot in the residential. It's difficult, but I appreciate you bringing up the school resource officer, and I think you did too, sir. And what do you know about the school resource officer? They're closer to the youth and may even be around them more than some of the parents.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't touch on that because I do oversee the SRO program in Rantoul, and really the focus of the SRO program in Rantoul is the resource part of the school resource officer program is providing, one, a relationship with the students to really get to know the students and know kind of really to be an outlet for them if there is a problem. And, you know, it's not the enforcement side. We don't look for our SROs to be the enforcement wing of the police department. They fall under our 4U program, so they're through our social-led initiatives. That's where it's run through. And we make sure that they have, you know, CIT training. They have training with juvenile law, juvenile problems, juvenile mental health, and all those things that, again, makes them a resource and not the enforcement wing of an SRO program.
I guess I misspoke. I was just kind of wondering, you know, what are you hearing from them that they may be hearing from some of the, you know, some of their youth?
Absolutely. So just as I kind of touched on here earlier about heroin, I mean, we're just not seeing the heroin that we used to see. It's all fentanyl based. It's all mostly pill based inside the schools that people are using. It's a pill based product, a fentanyl product that these products are coming out of Texas and Chicago, and they're usually nondescript or very poorly put together. And this seems to be, if they're, again, we'll always have cannabis, but if they're using another drug in the high school, it's usually some sort of pill-based, whether it's Xanax, whether it's those kind of things, or whether it's fentanyl. But again, we're starting to see that rise that we historically have not seen in the past.
Michelle?
Is the village receiving opioid settlement funds?
I have not heard of any, but I can't say for certain. I nothing has been brought to my attention, and I've managed the budget the last 6 years, but I feel like they probably would have said something had we received money, but I don't. So I can't say 100%, but I don't think so.
Okay. I mean, there's a list, so I can check for you.
Yeah, if you want to. I can't think of it, but
yeah. So possibly. It would be good to make sure we coordinate and pool our
Absolutely.
Efforts. Yeah.
Seeing no further questions, I want to thank you for your time coming here tonight, and also thank you for just the innovative approach. Not every municipality is handling this the same way as you, and we're grateful for what you've done up there. Thank you.
I appreciate the invite.
All right. Moving on, we have updates from staff.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so a couple of things. I did check in with the sheriff early on and was told that they do medical-assisted withdrawal in the jail, but given the repeated comments, I will follow up again with Captain Vogues about that, just to make sure that we're all on the same understanding of what that terminology means, because that might be the disconnect, is I think it means one thing, and to them it means something else. So I'll look into that. And for the question about running money through the Board of Health, that would honestly be the cleanest and easiest way to do this process. If you allocated money to the Board of Health for a specific project of, you know, whatever nature you want to outline and define, and then kind of give them the charge of making sure that project is executed, whether that, you know, most likely is going to be by CU PhD or whoever that is. But that would, like, that would be a very clean way for us to manage the money. So that's totally on the table and a good choice to do it. I also early on got a list of all the volunteer fire and police law enforcement departments in the county. And if we had wanted to, like, pay an intern or pay somebody just to go through and survey them, do you have Narcan? Do you have Narcan training? How often do you use it? To determine if that's a need, we could look into that as well. And then if you want, I can check in with the CCARTS people and just see if we wanted to put money towards it, could they do more back and forth trips on certain days? Like, you know, if they had a little bit more resource, is there something they could do? Or is it just they're maxed out no matter what's happening? So just so we know if we want to keep talking about that. Yes. I'll just ask. If they don't answer, they don't answer. Yeah.
We would like that. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. No harm in asking. So Liz reached out to all the surrounding counties, and Ford and Douglas did not get back to us. Piatt County did get back to us. They're mostly using their funds for Narcan training with law enforcement, community education about opioids, and really just community-based intervention projects. So it kind of sounds like they don't, you know, they don't have, like, the public health district that we have that's really done a lot of that work already. So they are definitely using their money wisely, but they're using it, I think, at a different level than where we need to be at. But they are interested in talking about a regional effort if we wanted to continue that conversation. So I think they're definitely taking the issue seriously and making the most of their money and see the importance of collaboration. Vermilion County is almost exclusively putting their money back into their probation and drug court program. So they're really funding all of those transportation, court dates, counseling, treatment. Like, they're really just trying to cover any cost that's a barrier for anyone that's in those two programs with an opioid addiction to make sure that they're as successful as possible. And they would also be interested in talking about a regional effort if we wanted to continue that conversation as well. And then I think Megan sent out the proposal from GIS, which I think is pretty much what we asked for. And I heard it mentioned earlier that data would be useful. I think we could build an initial dashboard that we could continue to add different layers to as we come across things that are interesting. Hearing the Deputy Chief's presentation, I think adding an age layer would be really interesting so that we can clearly see even over time how the age use of opioids has changed. I think that would be a good community education piece. And their price was surprisingly low, so for the very technical work that they do. So that is my updates.
Ms. Michaels.
Are we to discussion, kind of, or not?
Did you have a question?
A question for Michelle?
No, sorry.
Thank you for checking into all of that for us and being our boots on the ground. Now we'll move on to discussion. Ms. Michaels.
It sounds like. I'm not kidding. My kids can hear me half mile down the road when I really get to it. It sounds like we actually have some of the products that are necessary to help with the addictions and the overdoses and things like that. We're lacking the ability to get it out in the public and the information out in the public and having people trained to use it. So I think as there was three parts that these funds can be used for, I would like to see more heavily into the education part, whether it's the students or volunteers or things of that nature, because if people don't know what's going on, how are they going to help? And so to me, right now, we're at a point where we can start with the education because thank goodness we actually have the products that we can educate them with.
I'll second that at this point, absolutely education from the low level where children think that pills are safe and that's where they're overdosing. And then also with education of higher ups about the effectiveness and the availability of medically assisted treatment. We could talk about it. Further the discussion of how do we get there, how would we like to get to the education point. Any other thoughts? Jen?
I'm going to echo what Chris said. Some of my work does come down to folks who are ready to seek treatment, and treatment isn't always available or barriers come into place. And you know, those barriers can very quickly kind of chip away at a person's, you know, will to do something that is extremely hard and somewhat dangerous, right? So if we can use some of this money to fund, you know, whatever it looks like, if it's C-CART, if it's more telehealth options or whatever, if we can fund access to all of these products that we have available and to the services that we have available in our county, but not necessarily where people need them. I think that would go a long way.
Michelle, I didn't see you. You're blocked by Aaron. I would have seen you.
It's so awkward over here. I know. I don't know if I could put Joe on the spot and ask, do you like, have you surveyed or could you just tell us, like, these are the top five barriers for people coming from active using and wanting to stop? Like, what are, like, or do we need to do that kind of survey work to figure that out?
Like, what are the barriers to stop using?
Yeah, but like, depend, and I guess maybe the more specific thing is, you know, depending on where they are in the county, right? So the barriers for someone in Champaign-Urbana are going to be different for the barriers for someone in Rantoul, Philo, Sydney. So is that data already like generally exist based on like the urbanness of where someone lives, or is that a kind of a countywide survey that we should consider funding?
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. I mean, we know that you have better chances of being successful in treatment if you have more money, because then you can afford to go out of state and get far from home, which is a great interrupt of the addiction cycle. So, you know, money is a big one. Distance is another one. You know, so if you're closer to a place of recovery, then you have a higher chance of attending it because it's easier to get to.
Recovery homes. That's a barrier. There aren't adequate.
My colleague over here, Dave King from Carl, mentioned like recovery homes that. The further you are away from one, the harder it is. I mean, it goes without saying it's a huge problem, but stigma is still a really huge issue. This is something that we're currently doing some increased training on within the medical system, because it's hard for people to talk about their addiction. It's hard for people to say, I want help. So stigma still plays a really big barrier in this. The other thing that I was thinking about was, you know, our systems are set up for you're either using or you're clean, and when you're in that in-between stage, there's not a whole lot of services for you. You know, there's syringe exchange, there's ERs, there's some healthcare things in between. And medically assisted treatment, syringe exchange are both ways to kind of meet people in a when they're still middle of that stage of still using and headed towards recovery. So I don't know if that kind of answers your questions, but it's, you know, it's incredibly complex. I should probably add, like, you know, access to mental health counseling is, you know, a critical part of recovery, that, you know, you can have as many recovery homes as possible, but if they're not doing the mental health piece of it, that's a key critical piece of it, which almost all recovery related homes do that, but we just need to ensure that that's part of their priority.
Diane?
Well, just quick, my brain is going in a lot of directions. We learned a lot tonight. Thank you for that. I sit here and I think we have a certain dollar amount, pretty healthy pot right now, to get things started on the ground. We don't have very much to sustain it, quite frankly.
Right.
And that's my worry,
right,
is we want to do this good work, but we want to be careful of how we do it, that we want to be successful with it down the road. And many of the agencies that are helping people, they don't have the extra funds to sustain what we would like to undertake. And I think sometimes, unfortunately, we'll have to dial back pretty heavily on what we really want to accomplish. But it's a good thing to start somewhere. So I like the collaboration between the different departments and the different areas, both rural and urban, because I think it's necessary, because most of the services are definitely in the urban area, and everybody's got to work together. But I'm really concerned that we want to be able to maintain these and sustain them, and it's going to be very difficult for us to do that.
Well, and if I could maybe call on Dave to talk about, because we were talking about medically assisted recovery at the jail, and there is more funding that's out there for this. And so I'm gonna tap in Dave to take over.
Thanks, brother. So my name is Dave King. I'm the community outreach manager for Carl Addiction Recovery Services at Carl. And I didn't realize there was public participation. Otherwise, I would have signed up earlier. But specific to medication-assisted treatment, there is a grant available through SUPER, Substance Use Prevention and Rehabilitation, Department of DHS, $150,000. It's a very low bar. If you want the money, you'll get the money. And what that gets you access to is a national consultant, a group that's called Health Management Associates. Health Management Associates does this throughout the country, and they are working with, I think, now 19 different, maybe more, counties in Illinois that are implementing MAT in the jail. Iroquois County is the closest one. I guess Ford County is new as well. It basically just says to make progress toward implementation. So if you have money, and I'm going to have to talk to Judge Dyer, because we've already talked to probation, we've talked to the sheriff, we've talked to Judge Rosenbaum. We really don't have any vested interest in it as an organization. Our job, as funded through SUPER in this grant, is to do exactly what you're talking about, is help address the opioid epidemic and overdose. So this is one way that you can do that, specifically in Champaign County. And like I said, it's $150,000. It started off as a $50,000 grant. It's now $150,000. And I can forward you information, you know, about that. I have my business card. I'll leave with you. But they've done some research. I think Kendall County has, where they first implemented this, has actually put a video out in collaboration with SUPER. To show the benefits, which are things like reduced worker comp for the county, because guess what? People in custody who aren't sick from their withdrawal and their addiction aren't causing trouble for, you know, guards and so forth. It's tremendously effective, I think. So we would love to see this in every county, and is one of the leadership centers funded by Super. We've just tried to advocate for that. Vermilion County doesn't have it either, neither does Piatt County. Douglas County is now looking at doing that. So, you know, it's money they want to give away, yeah. Really. So that's one example. And, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
We were just talking amongst ourselves. We even have a grant writer now that we fund. So wouldn't it be great?
Yeah, and especially if you're looking to, when you're talking about sustainability, and you're also looking about how you can maximize. I mean, you can start something and use that 150K, you know, as well. A couple other things. There are programs in schools. Rosecrans has a prevention program. They're, again, through Super, they do a lot of prevention. I don't know if they do it in Rantoul, but they do it in Vermilion County. The program that's used primarily is Too Good for Drugs. That's the curriculum that they use. It is a evidence-based, you know, model. But too often, the prevention programs focus on substances and equipping parents on how to detect rather than build protective factors and resiliency and things like that. So there are some. Chestnut Health Systems does a lot of work on prevention. Jason Kilmer is a PhD guy out of Washington, the University of Washington, that we've had come and speak, who specifically does research in prevention, particularly in college-age kids, but has great information. And all I want to do is be a resource of information, so happy to, you know, share whatever, you know, we can.
Jen.
Dave, when John was here, he talked about, and I'm, you know, I'm getting this information, and I'm trying to regurgitate it as quickly as possible, so I'm going to sound like a muggle. He talked about Vivitrol being kind of the standard and it not necessarily being a good standard. Does the grant that you spoke of cover other and better?
Specifically focused on Suboxone.
Excellent.
And, you know, just to expand a little bit on Vivitrol, you know, Vivitrol is an injectable, does have some benefit for opioid management, but generally not. And when he says that it will block the cravings, what it does, it does not block the high. So you don't feel the high because it's, you know, it's an agonist, like he said. So you use more, which then puts you at greater risk for overdose. There is no overdose protective factor in Vivitrol, where Suboxone, buprenorphine, does. So it does both. It manages cravings and also offers, you know, protection. And the injection that they talked about, the sublocate injection, it's incredibly expensive. It's like $1,000 a pop. So that's the barrier, you know, where Suboxone, you know, is not as expensive. Thank you. Yeah.
Chris?
I tried to take some notes about what you were talking about.
I'll come back.
Well, if you could kind of email, you know, maybe Jen and she could pass it along, and maybe Michelle could kind of check with Captain Vogas. I see what we know.
We've met with all of them and understand that they're just competing priorities. You know, I mean, and it's resources and so on. So. Pardon me?
It's one more thing.
So not to be critical at all. It's just that it's, but it doesn't have to be implemented in 6 weeks or 6 months. It can be done, you know, over time. And part of it is just the education, you know, about it. Oftentimes what people are given in here is a bottle of water and a bottle of Gatorade. And so people recover in spite of our efforts. And, you know, we want to be able to, you know, help them with that. So transportation is a huge issue. Housing is a huge issue for, you know, long-term recovery. Vocational support's a huge issue, or the lack of them, another issue for long-term recovery.
Did I see a hand?
I was just going to say, I'll take one of your cards and I can check in with Captain Vogas about what support we could offer that would maybe move this up on the priority list. Yeah, it could be one of their top projects, one of their first projects. for sure. Especially if it's $150,000 just begging to be given away.
I'm also happy to facilitate a meeting with Kathleen Monahan, you know, one of the person at the state level that oversees the state opioid response grants, you know, to answer questions and help with that. Anyway, I know most of the people at Health Management Associates who, you know, do the technical assistance for this, you know, as well. If you wanted, you could, I think, this Wednesday. Every 2 weeks, they have clinical office hours where people can attend. You don't have to be doing MAT in the jail, but, it's for anybody who wants to either learn more about it or talk about, you know, what the operational, you know, issues are that they're encountering. But that would I will forward all this information to you then. Yeah.
Did you want to say something?
If I may,
Sorry, I'm just running.
No, it's perfect. Thank you, Dave. It was making me think of Ms. Michael's question about longevity. You know, it could be that you could approach the MAT at the jail with we want to pilot this, either using the money that you could get from the health management systems, but then say we could use the settlement money to continue the pilot, but to see how does the jail actually benefit from this, you know, other than not just for the benefit of the clients, but maybe the jail then would see, oh yeah, this is something that we could benefit from. This is something we want to budget for in the future when the funds run out. Something like that could be a good way to kind of make a push towards the jail staff.
And there are a couple other resources that are available right now to everybody. There's a program called Medication Assisted Recovery, MAR Now, N-O-W. And that's a toll-free number that anybody can call anywhere in the state, 24/7, 365. And they will be screened. It's a telescreening with the physician who will then prescribe them 14 days of Suboxone. And then link them up with one of the partners. It's operated through Family Guidance Center, which is located in Chicago and also Springfield. And what they do after that screening is link them up with one of their like regional partners to get them connected to local resources. So Carle Health is one of those. We've seen, our case manager was gone, so I was covering for her. So since October 19th, we had 15 referrals come through just for. It's a wide area, a wide geography that we cover. But again, that's to get them connected with an MAR, you know, provider. And that's done on an outpatient basis, right? So you don't have to go to residential and so on. I mean, we want to engage them in other supports, but it's a good program. Through the Illinois Helpline, too, you can call that and get that information. I'll throw all this at you, promise.
You might have mentioned this. There's been so much information, and I'm writing furiously. How frequently does somebody have to get Suboxone or methadone or the various treatment times? What are the differences in how people have to get it?
Well, I'm not a doctor.
Oh, I'll ask over here.
Mean,
yeah.
But methadone's a daily dosing.
Okay.
And that's done, I mean, unless you've been well established and they may still give you daily dosing, but you take home. Otherwise, you have to come in to that place. And I think what Mr. Peterson was talking about, it's highly, highly regulated. I mean, the DEA is all over it. So there are mobile units for MAR that the state is trying to facilitate. Family Guidance Center is trying to do that in Springfield and serve like a 6-county area. The regulations are incredibly cumbersome. You know, it really has delayed implementation of that. And since it's daily dosing and you're trying to do this in rural communities, it basically means you're taking that mobile unit, not to be flip, but you're kind of a mule. Yeah. You're going from one community to another every day to make sure people get their dosing. Mm-hmm. Suboxone is a lot more flexible. And since they did away with the waiver requirement, meaning that you had to have a special application and regulation to waive to prescribe and get training, you now no longer need that. Virtually any provider, you know, can prescribe Suboxone, and any prescriber can. And we have, through our grant, a training program that we're doing where we train, I think now we have 20 providers, probably from a 10-county area, that go through a 5-month fellowship to learn how to prescribe Suboxone more effectively and work with patients and that. But they're, we tried to target deserts where there weren't providers. The rural area is a completely different story, as you've already heard. It's more, you know, methamphetamine is an issue.
Thank you. Does anyone else have any questions for our secondary speakers? Thank you so much. We were so happy you're here.
I'm glad Joe told me about it.
Dave, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Bring a friend every time. Thank you. Dr. Storr.
Thank you. Just asking because although I've kind of heard of some of these drugs and so forth, is there kind of like a they used to call it a cheat sheet, but a study guide or a one or two pager that kind of lists some of these things that you've discussed in terms of the drugs? Or is that kind of
you can get
look
them.
It up.
Yeah, off the I mean, there you can. I mean, and this is I'm going to own this completely as my own bias is that, you know, the so. I cover a pretty wide geography, and I'm in a lot of different meetings similar to this as well. And the fascination always is with the substance. And that's not where our focus should be. You know, our focus really needs to be on the person. Stigma is tremendous. I mean, part of the fascination, you know, with the substance is because of we just can't believe people would do this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Or that it's still a choice. I mean, this is all stigma. You know, we still call it substance abuse instead of substance use and misuse. So there are. You can go to SAMHSA's website. You can go to a number and get those kinds of things. But the reality is our approach needs to be we meet people where they're at. We do that in a non-judgmental, accepting way. And we keep them alive and reduce their risks through programs that Joe's doing, through harm reduction, so that they have the opportunity to recover. That's what we do.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, just like in my own area of engineering geology, we have our jargon. And it helps to know the jargon. Not because it's trying to keep people out, it's because it's a quick way for us to kind of talk about some things without too much elaboration. And that's kind of where I was going with that.
If there's no other questions, I think maybe we should bring it back to sort of a discussion of where we would like to go. Do we want to fund a study from GIS that's practically, I think, less than each one of us is paid in, you know, in our per diems through the year. It's very small. Do we want to talk about funding that through? Do we want to – anybody – I'm open to thoughts.
Well, I'll just lay it out here. Actually, when I looked at that and I read it, I think we're going to need to have a map of some sort. No matter what we do and where we go, we need to have – a map of what is happening, the different ages, I think, would be a good thing. Like we talked earlier, is adding that as one of the parameters in there, if they can do that. And that would be almost like us putting out our little, I don't know, I can't think of the word right now. But anyway, that would be our roadmap to what we do and how we use our money, is to know what is happening right now and where we could best use it. I still want to feel very strongly about educating also and educating our younger people because I've seen that a lot too, and we all have. But I also believe in what these gentlemen are talking about, and thank goodness that other guy came. I'm sorry, the other guy.
Thank you.
The guy from Carl. Thank good the guy from Carl came because it added a little bit more information about what needs to be maintained, and that is our jail medical assistance recovery, because that's where we see a lot of them come into our faces. Although there are people that maybe anonymously would want to get help, we have that opportunity right there. And I think working with our jail population, because that takes the whole county, because everybody ends up there, from the U of I, from Champaign, Urbana, Oriental, wherever, That would touch many of our areas with people that have some issues. So I think we need the roadmap from GIS, and I really strongly want to look at the jail medical assistance recovery, which I believe Sheriff Harriman had a very nice layout of what he's seen in the last year in the Sheriff's Department, and that could also be incorporated into the GIS mapping project. And then that would also maybe give us an idea of where to do that education. The grant, low-hanging fruit, we shouldn't be leaving that on the table, and anything else that these gentlemen can bring forward to us. So that's my
thoughts. Thank you, Diane, for saying my thoughts without me having to say them. Like, each one of those things are priorities at this moment. Do we kind of have consensus kind of? Or, go ahead, Jen.
Are we going to then go ahead and thumbs up the GIS project now?
Yes. Thumbs up. Anybody opposed to funding the GIS study? Nope. Unanimous. So we would like to do that. And as towards anything else, maybe we start a conversation with medical detox, furthering that in the jail. And then also we steer our grant writer towards this new low-hanging fruit, if available. I have Michelle's face. Is this possible?
Yeah, certainly. So it sounds like to-dos are, I'm going to check in with Captain Bogus and maybe see if her and the sheriff will even come to the next meeting so we can have a more detailed conversation about this term and what's actually happening. And I will follow up with Mr. King about the grant and figure out how low-hanging this is. Can we just get this going now while we onboard a grant writer? I'll follow up with GIS to get started on the contract. And I'll check in with CCARTS to see if there's any level of funding that they could be more accessible, particularly for people dealing with opioid-related appointments.
I wonder if it would be... I don't know, so I'm asking. would it be helpful to ask Dr. Peterson to come back during the conversation regarding the jail so we had somebody who was fluent in medically assisted recovery during that conversation?
Well, I think we would want Mr. King to be here as well, so I'm totally volunteering.
You should have somebody from Iroquois County come.
Okay.
Or other people, and I can connect you with them, but they're doing a phenomenal job. They're using their settlement money to actually supplement their...
We are so thankful you're here tonight. Thank you. Okay, so with our to-dos, now we'll move on. Next meeting, we have a general idea of what we're going to want. Everybody's availability looked good for December 4th. Does that work for everybody? The room is available? Mm-hmm. All right, next meeting will be December 4th. There is no chair's report. I am sorry this took so long. It was wonderfully full of great information.
We didn't make the hour and a half that we had planned on, but I'm totally fine that we didn't.
Yeah.
I mean, for this type of a meeting,
yeah, it wasn't boring. It was good.
Well, it's not like we were just rehashing what we'd maybe already rehashed. We'd learned.
Yes.
I mean, like I said, I'm not sorry that it took over the hour and a half. That was the ideal, I guess you could say, length.
Well, with that said, thank you, everybody. Would we like to adjourn? All right. It is 8:26. This meeting is adjourned.